If you were to take a peek into the collective nightmares that we have these days, chances are pretty good you'd find zombies in them. I mean, zombies are pretty much everywhere. I was trying to make a mental list of how many TV shows about zombies are on the air right now. I think there are four. I couldn't even begin to count how many zombie movies there are, zombie video games, zombie comic books. Zombies are everywhere. And if you're trying to figure out why we're so interested in zombies, I mean, why did zombies overtake vampires, for example, that were not that long ago sort of the cultural epicenter of our lives? But zombies certainly dominate now. Why is that? What does it say about us that we're so interested in zombies? Greg Garrett has written a terrific new book, Living with the Living Dead: The Wisdom of the Zombie Apocalypse. I would have to say, hands down, the most thoughtful book about zombies ever written. Greg joins us for the first time on Coast to Coast in just a moment. Stick around. Welcome back. BBC Radio has called Greg Garrett one of America's leading voices on religion and culture. He's written on such topics as spirituality and suffering, film and pop culture, U2, Harry Potter, faith and politics. He's the author of more than 20 books of fiction, nonfiction, memoir, and translation. And he's also has taught at Baylor University since 1989, is a theologian in residence at the American Cathedral in Paris, and he's here to talk about his latest work, Living with the Living Dead. Welcome to the program, Greg.
Oh, thanks so much, George. It's great to be with you all tonight.
Man, I really enjoyed the book. I mean, it says so much about us as opposed to zombies, but it casts a pretty wide net over the zombie culture and phenomena as well. Was there a particular point that you can remember where you looked around at the media landscape and said, where the heck did all these zombies come from?
Well, you know, when I was working on an earlier book for Oxford University Press, which was the publisher for this book, for Living with the Living Dead, I was doing a chapter on the undead in literature and culture, and the chapter just got bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger, and the manuscript was going to be maybe 300 pages, and this was a chapter that was 100 pages and growing, and most of it was about zombies. And I think that was maybe the first time I realized that this is something that is just cascaded. And then I started looking around and realizing that The Walking Dead was at that time the most popular TV show in the world. And I thought to myself, why on earth would all of these different people from different cultures and, you know, different ages and, you know, political beliefs, I mean, what is it about the zombie that unifies us in a time when we were sort of divided about every single thing else? And that's sort of when I became fascinated by it and decided, hey, there needs to be a book about this, and I guess I need to spend a couple of years thinking about this and writing it.
Well, it's great work. You make the point at several points in the book about the general theme, the apocalyptic version. It's not necessarily always zombies, but that kind of story extends through human history.
Yeah, it's in our DNA, it seems like, that we are always going to be wondering how the world is going to end and how we're going to react to it. And whether it's a religious version, as it is in some of the scriptures from Jewish and Christian tradition, or these pop culture versions, which have kind of sort of taken over the world in recent years, there is this fascination that we have about, you know, how are things going to end? And what is really interesting to me about all this is that these new versions really sort of ask us, how are we going to act if the world ends? Because most of the earlier versions, like if you read the Revelation, you know, at the end of the New Testament, you go, well, okay, that's it. It's over. But in these stories, it's over, and then human beings sort of go on if they can survive. And the question then becomes, what are we willing to do to survive, and what will it take for us to survive? And that is just fascinating, because that's drama right there. I mean, it's human decisions in action that we get to watch.
Early in the book, you quote one of the writers and producers of the Walking Dead series who told you something at the Austin Film Festival about what the show is about and what it isn't about. Can you tell me that?
Yeah, absolutely. I've actually been on a couple of panels with Angela Kang, who is executive producer and writer for The Walking Dead. And what she said actually helped me sort of put things in perspective as I was wrestling with this whole why are zombies so popular thing. because it actually, in a sense, is not about zombies, although we'll probably talk about how it is in some ways. But for her, as a writer of The Walking Dead, the zombies are furniture, so to speak. You know, kind of like in Harry Potter, you know, there are magic wands, and in Star Wars, there are spaceships. But the stories work because they're about the human beings. And so what Angela said is, you know, The Walking Dead is not about zombies, although that's what you're going to see in all the advertising and things like that. But what our show is really about is the sort of crucible that gets created when human beings are put in this position of, like, extreme stress, and go into survival mode. And this whole question of survival, she says, is what is at the heart of The Walking Dead, and really all of these stories about the zombie apocalypse. It's what sorts of choices will these characters make? What will Rick do? What will Michonne do? What will the villains do in this world where all of our supports are pulled out from under us, where there's no longer a legal system or a functioning traffic light? Churches and civic institutions. I mean, who are we when the lights go out and there is nothing to tell us what to do?
You look at the most recent season of The Walking Dead, and surely I'm assuming you are a regular viewer, certainly at least for the purposes of writing this book. But it's not about zombies. Zombies are almost an afterthought. It's about how people interact with each other.
Yeah, the situations that have grown out of this story were really kind of planted in it by the creator of the story who wrote the comic book. And what he wanted to do was to sort of create this ongoing narrative, which would sort of show us what happens when people are put in these situations. And as we look at what's going on the show right now, it's not about clearing zombies out. It's about these conflicts between what we could sort of think of as a geopolitical kind of conflict, because we've got all these communities that have sort of grown up in the wake of the zombie apocalypse, and the different ways that they approach how to live in this world. And so you've got, a culture that's sort of grown up around this strong man, you know, who literally carries a big stick. And another culture that is sort of dedicated to peace and trying to preserve the civilization as they remember it in Alexandria, and other civilizations out there as well. And what they're trying to do is to survive, but in a world of sort of dwindling resources and all of these sort of exterior menaces like the zombies, we're seeing what's played out there is very sort of accurate in terms of our everyday life. You know, when I get up in the morning and I go, yeah, North Korea is scaring me to death today. The world of The Walking Dead does not feel so strange to me.
Can you put it on a graph and trace when apocalyptic sort of visions become heightened, as charted compared to what's going on in the world?
You know, I think you probably can. And I am not a social scientist. I'm a narrative person. You know, I write and do stories. So what I have is more anecdotal, but it seems to correspond to a bunch of kind of flashpoints in human history. And in the book, I talk about a few of those going back into the Middle Ages, during the plague years, for example. And I was reading a history of the Middle Ages and not even really thinking about this book, but it talked about civil unrest and violence in the streets and economic unrest and natural disasters and pandemics and all of these other things. And I looked up from the book and I remember saying to my wife, you know, I don't think the 14th century was really that different from us. And then I started noticing that the art of the day, the art and the literature, begins to sort of put death front and center. You see corpses and cadavers. You see walking death. Like capital D, death, in a lot of the different kind of art forms that are represented from the Middle Ages. And then I just started looking for some other places where that happens. And it happens in the trenches of World War One, the art and poetry that grows out of that. It's in art from Hiroshima and Nagasaki and from the Vietnam War. And the Vietnam War then led me to 1968, which is when our first George Romero zombie movie comes out. And so when you look at those sort of particular flashpoints, and then you look at our situation in post 9/11 America, it sort of feels like we are in that same kind of groove where we feel menaced by a bunch of things that are going on around us. So zombies are not popular, for example, during the Reagan era, really. You know, when it's morning in America and people feel hopeful, they're popular when people feel like death is coming at them from every direction and when there are all of these threats. And I think that's one of the reasons that the zombie as a symbol is so important and so powerful, because it can stand in for us for some of those things in times when we really feel like, you know, things could go very badly.
You wrote in the book at one point that zombies are, in fact, scientifically demonstrated to be among the most frightening menaces we could watch. What do you mean by that?
Well, there's some research about what people who work with robots call the uncanny valley, which is an idea that we are comfortable with robots that we can tell are robots, but the closer they get to being human, the more they fit into this place where we feel that there is something strange and eerie about them. And zombies look like us. And in fact, in a lot of the movies, there is this kind of trope that you don't really notice that they're zombies until sometimes it's too late. So they appear to be like us. They walk on two legs. You know, they function in a lot of the ways that we function. But when they get closer, and we take a look, and whether it's, you know, that parts of them are dropping off, or that, you know, their eyes are wrong, or, you know the gash in their face that no human could survive, we look at that and we go, oh my God, you know, they're us, but they're not us. And so those researchers put zombies sort of in the deepest part of the uncanny valley. And so that is the kind of scientific basis for saying that zombies are maybe the most frightening monsters, although I would have to say clowns do it for me.
Yeah, clowns are right up there. You mentioned, you sprinkle throughout the book references to zombie milestones, and as you already mentioned, George Romero's Night of the Living Dead, 1968, a lot of zombie literature owes a debt to Romero. 1968, of course, a heck of a lot of interesting stuff going on in the U.S. and around the world.
Yeah, that was, I mean, it was a really challenging year. And, I mean, your listeners will remember that, you know, we were in the middle of the Vietnam War. We had a president who was deciding that he's not going to run for a second term. And whether you supported or didn't support LBJ, that's a scary kind of transition when the person you thought was going to be president decides that he doesn't want to be. We had, you know, the changes in sexual and religious mores. We had the assassination of a couple of really important public figures. 1968 is one of those years when it just looked like, you know, we were going to hell in a handbasket. And what we always say about artists is that they, in some ways, feel more deeply than the sort of general population, that they pick up on what's going on in the zeitgeist. And what George Romero and his co-writer did was they took some earlier ideas about ghouls and sort of undead monsters who consume human flesh and married it with the idea of the Caribbean zombie, these sort of non-thinking, you know, walking dead kind of figures, and created this zombie apocalypse story that we are living in the middle of now. And so 68 is really sort of ground zero for us. And there were some earlier versions of the zombie, like we said, and some earlier versions of these monsters. But 68 is where we sort of see it all come together. And when Romero passed away recently, there were, you know, tons of tributes from other zombie storytellers, you know, just basically saying, you know, George was the person who made this possible. We could not have told our stories without him.
Yeah, it sort of establishes the rules for what we understand about zombies, although I guess the eating brains thing came later.
The eating thing, brains thing did come later in one of the later Living Dead movies. And it really is an interesting kind of scene because it offers a little bit of motivation. I think earlier it was just, you know, zombies will eat any part of you. And in many of the stories, that actually is still sort of what they've got. But, you know, when we think about zombies now, brains is one of the first things we think about. And that scene actually kind of gave a metaphysical reason for it, that zombies ate brains to sort of relieve the pain of being dead and aware that they were dead. So in some ways, it's a little bit outside the scope of most zombie stories, because in most zombie stories, zombies aren't aware they're anything except maybe hungry. But it does come from a later film and not from those George Romero films.
Not to belabor the point, but you point out early in the book that the opening credits for the film World War Z, which I thought was a pretty good zombie movie, is a montage of all the problems going on in the world.
Yeah, and that is a really powerful opening sequence, because it's intercutting all of the human problems with a bunch of stuff going wrong in nature. And I've read a couple of things lately. I didn't talk an awful lot about this in the book, and sort of dropped a mention here or there, but there have been a bunch of articles in the last year or so linking the zombie apocalypse with the idea of climate change and with other kinds of huge sort of world-shifting ideas that we don't know what to do about. And even if we agreed, which we don't, that they're all happening. But one of the things that I think the opening of that movie does is it sort of says, you know, here are all these things that seem to be going wrong with us and going wrong with the planet, and maybe there's something tying all this together, and let's tell a zombie story.
You make the point, too, and it's clever on the part of governments and other and corporate entities to use zombies as a way to tell a story or get a message across, and it's an eye-grabber, that's for sure.
Yeah, I was really interested that Sam Brownback, the governor of Kansas, who I don't think of as a particularly hip guy,
yeah,
I'm sure a really nice guy, but there was the story that I talked about in the book of him, you know, signing off on Zombie Awareness Month for the state of Kansas. And what I think he probably realized, and the Centers for Disease Control also realized, and other people who have used the zombie trope as a way of kind of drawing people's attention, is that the kinds of emergencies that get talked about in the zombie apocalypse stories are the kinds of emergencies that actually do happen in real life, minus the zombies. You know, we can as you know, just from the last few weeks, here in Texas and on the East Coast and the Caribbean, we have these disasters where people, you know, really, if they're not prepared, you know, that there's no telling what can happen. And so what Governor Brownback said is that, you know, if you're prepared for a zombie apocalypse, you're prepared for anything.
So yeah, we talk about that subject sort of on this program from time to time, whether it's the power grid going down or an invasion or you know, a variety of different kinds of scenarios that could play out that leave people on their own for a long time or a while anyway. It doesn't hurt to be ready for it.
Yeah, and I mean, I would encourage your listeners to be prepared for a zombie apocalypse, because as you say, it, you know, it prepares us for a loss of power, it prepares us for pandemic, for natural disaster, for invasion, God forbid, and I guess anything up to and including a zombie apocalypse.
So there are a bunch of TV, there are of course a bunch of TV shows with zombies in it, but it goes much further. You cast a wider net and have a broader definition of what fits under the zombie tent. You include Game of Thrones, for example?
Yeah, absolutely. And those of your listeners who have been watching the last season, just concluded, know that it was much more zombie-oriented this year than in previous years. Typically, what people think about when they think of Game of Thrones is they think about intrigue, they think about violence, they think about sex, and they don't think so much about zombies. But the first scene of the book, the first scene of the TV series, is about the dead coming to life. And in this last season, it became kind of the central thing that clearly the show and its makers.
I'll tell you what, Greg, I'm sorry to ask you there. I didn't give you enough time to answer it. We'll do it on the other side. Greg Garrett, Living with the Living Dead. We're talking with Greg Garrett, author of Living with the Living Dead, Comparisons and Lessons from the Zombie Apocalypse Scenario that is so common in media these days. We'll be right back and talk about what the zombies tell us about ourselves. Greg Garrett, before the break, I was asking you about Game of Thrones. I hate to, at the risk of being flogged, I don't watch the show, so having zombies mixed in there was a surprise to me until I read it in your book. It just didn't seem like it would fit. Then again, after reading your book, it fits into a lot of different narratives. Please continue.
Yeah, well, I was just talking about how, you know, most of us, when we think about Game of Thrones, or you know, you, George, who have not seen it, you know, probably have at least some perceptions of it. And you said zombies didn't seem to be at the heart of it for you. But a couple of seasons ago, one of the characters said something that really has turned into the kind of driving force for these last two seasons, the one we just watched and the final one, which will be coming out in a couple of years. The only war that battles is the war between life and death. And so the title, Game of Thrones, has been, to this point, about who's going to sit on the Iron Throne. But at the end of the day, if the dead win, you know, that it doesn't matter if Cersei or Dany or Jon Snow or whoever sits on the Iron Throne. Or as someone said this season, whose corpse sits on the Iron Throne? Because this has turned into now a story about life versus death, about the zombie apocalypse. And that's one of the things that I think has made it even more popular over the last year or two. Exploded this season and sort of pushed The Walking Dead aside as the most popular show in the world. And so I think really what's operating this season and next season is going to be that we're going to be largely oriented around these characters who we've come to know and come to love or hate, and what reaction they're going to make to this world that they now live in, where they realize that the dead are walking.
You make the point in the book about the zombie myth, and I'm using air quotes around the word myth, because as you say, that myth does not necessarily mean that something is false or unprovable. And although we don't know of any potential virus that will turn us into zombies, the idea of a pandemic is not all that out of the ordinary or unlikely. You know, you think about Stephen King's The Stand. I mean, that's a pretty wild story, but it's not out of the realm of possibility. And you also use the movie The Road, which is, it becomes kind of a zombie story, even though it's not technically about zombies.
Right. The Road does everything that the zombie apocalypse does, except as a couple of zombie-themed publications have pointed out, as if I didn't notice. There are no actual supernatural or scientifically, you know, caused zombies like we're used to. But what The Road is about, both the Cormac McCarthy novel and the film, is about, you know, a father and son who are trying to survive in a world where some sort of disaster has happened and there's no food, nothing is growing, no living animals really, and everything has become so scarce that human beings are eating each other. And, you know, how do you survive in a world like that where, you know, you could fall asleep and be dead before you wake up? And so in that story, there is this very clear sense that even though it's not supernatural zombies, that focus on human survival and the ethics of how you survive and keep the people you love alive, for me, was very much the same as in, you know, The Walking Dead or Game of Thrones or any of the zombie movies. And so I think that there are a lot of stories. You mentioned also The Stand, and some of the other stories and films that have come out recently about pandemics. You know, what do we do in response to that? How do we survive, let alone thrive, in a world where, you know, everything that we knew and loved is gone in some way?
You know, The Road is, it's a powerful and unforgettable film, but I mean, it's a kind of movie that I only watched once, because it just is so stark and it's tough to take. But I guess, you know, in that scenario, we become the zombies, not literal zombies like in The Walking Dead, but become cannibals. And you got to figure that a lot of humans would make some pretty bad choices if faced with that kind of a scenario.
Well, we become the zombies is actually one of the things that a lot of the zombie stories are about. In The Walking Dead, both in the comic and later on the show, one of the main characters, Rick, actually utters the line, "We are the Walking Dead." And in a lot of these stories, in the movies and TV shows, the choices that people make can make them inhuman. And so what Angela Kang also told me, the writer and executive producer of The Walking Dead, is that the humans are always the villains of their show, not the zombies, because they actually become worse than zombies in a way. And so when you've got human beings, like you were saying, who choose cannibalism, make that hard choice, that's one thing. But in a lot of these stories, people actually victimize others. You know, there's a couple of times in The Walking Dead, there's in 28 Days Later, the British zombie film, where people actually entice people to their location in hopes of some sort of safety, and then feast on them. And, you know, the point that I think those stories make is, you know, even the zombies are not this bad. You know, they kill because they're hungry. That is their only drive. But if human beings can make this choice and do make this choice, that makes them worse monsters still.
You make the point a couple of places in the book, different scenarios. I think from Shaun of the Dead is an example that you mentioned, where you're confronted with someone, a loved one, who becomes a zombie, and you're faced with a question of whether you're going to shoot them or not. I think Sean tells his mother that monster inside a car is not the stepfather. And there was a similar scenario in The Walking Dead, where Herschel has his zombie son out in the barn with a bunch of other zombies and is reluctant to kill him, even knowing that there could be dire consequences if they don't take that step.
Yeah, that is one of the most familiar of the actions that takes place in a zombie story. And I think it gets told over and over again because it is so horrific. Some of the actors from these different stories over the years have said that what they felt like the great drive, getting people to watch their show or their movie, is that it puts them in the situation where they would ask themselves, what would I do? So when we were talking about The Road just a second ago, would I eat someone else? Would I kill someone else to protect my son? I mean, those choices, which are really, really hard choices. And so I think that whole what would you do if your loved one became a zombie thing is one of those really hard choices. And Herschel chooses not to to destroy his son. And in fact, you know, in the comic, less so in the show, but in the comic he says, you know, we don't know what's going to happen. We don't know how they became zombies. We don't know if maybe they'll stop being zombies. And, you know, that doesn't seem very likely. But it also keeps him from having to make that really hard choice and going through the horrific action of taking care of his son out in the barn. But in other stories... No, yeah, go ahead.
No, go ahead. In other stories?
Well, I was going to say, in other stories, the people who know that they're about to become zombies actually ask people not to let them walk around like that, not to let them become monsters. And it is often played as a kind of mercy killing. If you can call it something, you know, when we don't really think of the zombies as having souls, but it is a mercy to the person involved to know that they're not going to have to be reanimated and walk around and possibly kill people that they love. So, you know, the story can go both ways, but it's always really powerful. And I think that's, as I said, one of the reasons that it shows up in almost every story.
Well, that scenario comes up in real life where people, maybe parents, say to their kids, look, don't let me live as a vegetable. If this scenario comes up, pull the plug.
Yeah, and that's the amazing thing about this story about zombies walking the earth, is that it really is full of ethical dilemmas that have a real-life dimension for us. And I love how you have pulled out that particular one, because it's, you know, it asks us as the zombie stories to do to to ask, at what point do people stop being alive or stop being human? And so for us, that question is, you know, oriented around mercy killing. But in the show, it's, you know, at what point are you no longer living and you become one of the living dead? And there's a, actually, you may remember, there's a passage in the book where I talk about the first time that I was ever sort of in the presence of a dead person.
Yeah, that's a great story.
Have so wrecked my life that as I was there in the hospital serving as a hospital chaplain, there was a part of my mind that was just going, please don't sit up in bed, please don't sit up in bed.
Well, tell the scenario, describe it in detail.
Well, this is a couple of years ago when I was in seminary, I was serving as a hospital chaplain here in Austin at the trauma hospital. And so there were all sorts of terrible things happening all day because this is where people got brought when they were in a car crash or if somebody drowned or somebody overdosed. And so I was seeing terrible things in the emergency room all the time, but usually they ordered me out about the time that somebody passed away. And if they didn't have people in the emergency room, and often they didn't because they had been brought directly there, then there was nobody for me to talk with. But one night I was on call, and this was shortly into my chaplaincy, and I got called into an ordinary hospital room where the man in the room had gone into cardiac arrest, and they were trying to save him. And the nurse turned to me and said, you need to go out. The family is in the waiting room. I don't think that we're going to save him. And, of course, that's not something that I could tell them because that's a medical judgment, and I can't, you know, pass that on. But I did go out there prepared because this was going to be the first time that I had to wrestle with this. And like many of us in Western culture, I've been sort of separated from death my whole life. Every funeral that I had ever been to was a closed casket funeral, or my mom wouldn't let me up close to it. And so I'd never really seen death close up in person. And over the course of the summer, that happened to me a number of times, but this was the very first time. And so after the man passed away and his family and I came back into the room, and they wanted to pay last respects and they wanted to pray, and they asked me to pray over the body, and I just was standing there, and I had a hand on the man's shoulder and a hand on the wife. And I remember thinking, there is a dead body under my hand. There's a dead body under my hand. And I also had that image that I was just telling you about of all of those zombie movies where the body under the sheet suddenly, you know, sits up and scares the bejesus out of everybody. And because it was a working situation, I was able to kind of put that back down. But that is something that we've seen so many times that I could not sort of get it out of my mind.
You were also asked, you were asked by the doctors when it looked like this person was going to go, they asked you, hey, you're going to have to go out and tell the family, get them ready for what's coming here, which was also a first for you.
Yeah, that was also a first. And it also kind of made me think about that dividing line that we were talking about earlier, because, you know, when I was in the room, although he was dying, he was still alive. I mean, and something happened in the 5 or 10 or 15 minutes, you know, before the doctor came out to give us the final report. But I was thinking about that as well, which is one of the things that I think the zombie stories do make us think about, that dividing line and what happens to us in that moment, which I'm sure is something that you all have talked about on the show before. You know, what happens to people who have a near-death experience? What's going on in that time when you're not really alive? But, you know, that was the first time that I'd actually been thinking about that transition as well. What is it that happens to us in that moment?
And what's the difference? I mean, what changes? You know, it's the difference between humans and zombies. What do we have that they don't have? And it's theological, spiritual question. That one way to look at it is talking about the soul.
Yeah, and in fact, Angela Kang said that's the difference. You know, she said humans have a soul. And, you know, however you understand that, whether you think of that theologically or metaphysically or biologically, if we think of the soul as the place where all of us that is us kind of resides, the things that make us, those are present in us up to the moment of death. And then they're gone, presumably. And zombies do not have those. And that is one of the things that's sort of operating in all of the George Romero-based zombies, that these are literally walking corpses. And the confusion that we have, as we said earlier, is that they resemble us so much. And some of them may be people that we knew and loved, and we want to believe that some tiny piece of them is still there. But, you know, most of the time that is played tragically. A few years ago on The Walking Dead, one of the villains of the story, the governor, kept his zombie daughter with him because, like Herschel, we were talking about earlier, he couldn't bear to kill her. And he thought that there was maybe some part of it that was still present. You know, he could not push her away. It's also sometimes played for laughs in Shaun of the Dead, which we talked about earlier. The funny thing about that is that at the end of the story, when one of the major characters becomes a zombie, he's actually not that different than he was alive. You know, he still wants to play video games, and he's still really hungry. So,
You mentioned having been on a couple of panels and talking about zombies and interacting with the creators of these programs. How were you received at these kind of gatherings?
Well, I've been doing stuff for the Austin Film Festival for about 17 years. One of my former students was the director of the festival. And shortly after I moved to Austin in 2000, he asked me if I would like to come and meet some of these filmmakers and to have conversation with them. And because I also teach screenwriting, you know, so I teach literature classes and I talk about pop culture and film in classes, and I also teach writing. So there's a part of my life where that is a very natural thing for me. But more recently, especially since I've been writing so much about film, I've been invited to do a lot of these panels where I get to ask questions like this of people who have written things like The Walking Dead or I Am Legend, and actually kind of use them for the work that I do. And for this book, the zombie book, I got to talk to a whole lot of filmmakers and screenwriters and producers who helped me to think about how they use the story and what they're consciously doing, as well as my thinking about how audiences react to it by seeing, you know, how the shows get reviewed and how I react to it and things like that. So it's really been a fascinating kind of thing. And some of the folks who I've talked to about the zombie story have read the book and really liked it. And that's gratifying as well. These people, you know, who are sort of professional purveyors of the zombie story, to recognize that maybe I got some things right.
Well, good. I was curious whether they would view academicians as with suspicion, but you note in the book that there are other papers and academics who have taken on the topic at different times. When we come back, we're going to get into a discussion of the human choices that are made and what we learn from that in the various zombie shows that are on the air and in the theaters. We're talking with Greg Garrett about his book, Living with the Living Dead.